on our platform. So if you're familiar with the newer tool set called Adobe Connect, this one will not be as interactive. We're going to revert back to the old approach where each individual attendee has to either pull up or download a copy of the presentation material and will be required to manually advance through the materials based on verbal cues from our speakers. Again, if you're just joining us, I'm on slide number 2, the housekeeping slide. When you signed up for today's seminar, you would have been directed to the seminar homepage, which has a complete description for today's broadcast, contact information, as well as bios for myself and the other presenters, links to download PowerPoint and PDF copies of the materials, as well as a button that says Go to Seminar in the upper left corner. If you click that button, it'll ask you to check yourself in and actually be able to look at the slides through a web browser window. And if you're just joining us, again, we're on slide number 2, the housekeeping slide. We are going to broadcast today's audio for the event in 2 ways. Those of you who have already joined us via the telephone lines have been placed on a global mute, and we ask that everybody remain muted until we take breaks for Q&A. At that point, I'll provide instructions on how to unmute your phone lines, but until then, please remain muted to help cut down on other audio disruptions and background noises. If you need to, you may disconnect from the phone call and rejoin us at any time. We'd encourage you not to place the phone call on hold, as that can cause other audio disruptions or music that we don't need in the background. Online audio streaming has already begun, and you'll be able to listen to the entire broadcast either through your computer or mobile device. We will take breaks throughout today's broadcast to take questions and answers with our presenters. For those of you on the phones, again, I'll provide instructions on how to unmute to ask a question out loud. But for those of you that are looking at the slides online in a web browser window or are streaming the audio online, you'll be required to type up your questions electronically. So if I can draw your attention to those orange circles or icons along the top of your slides, you can use those to move through the materials as well as submit your questions. The single arrow pointing to the left will go back one slide. The single arrow pointing to the right will move you forward one slide. The numbered links on the left will also help you navigate through the materials. We're on slide number 2. The question mark icon at the top will allow you to electronically submit comments, questions, or report technical problems. Just be sure that your pop-up blockers have been disabled. If you have any problems with that, you're certainly welcome to send an email directly to me, ballant.jean@epa.gov, and I'll be sure to take your question and pull it into the queue for our speakers. Our entire broadcast is going to be recorded, and you will automatically receive an email as soon as that archive is available, whether you participated live or did not. You're welcome to forward that email on to anyone that you think will find it useful. It usually takes us about 1 to 2 weeks to post those recordings. So, again, I encourage you to keep your eye peeled for that, as well as browse the nearly 500 recorded Kluwen seminars that are currently available on our archive page shown at the bottom of slide 2. At the end of today's seminar, I'll also provide some important information on how you can download the materials, provide feedback for today's session, as well as receive confirmation of your attendance in our live broadcast. So I think that's the end of the official reminder items that I have for everyone today. So I'm going to direct everyone to move along to slide number 2. And at this point, I'm going to turn things over to one of our first speakers, Kirby Biggs, who's joining us from the Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. Kirby, whenever you're ready.
Hi, Jean. Thanks very much. I appreciate that. And welcome, everybody. I'm so happy that you're able to attend this presentation. This is number 1 of 2, as Jean mentioned. We'll be having our case studies presentation on May 8th, and we'll be talking about that in just a second. I'm actually moving now to slide 4, which is the session agenda. And once again, this is part 1 of 2. Part 2 of 2 is coming up on May 8th. In that, we will look at optimization case studies for Black Butte, Grant Solvents, and Gilt Edge Mine. Today, we are doing an overview, which is a reprise of our NARPM 2012 presentation that discusses optimization in the more general sense of the National Optimization Strategy, and then looks at, for each part of the pipeline stage, that is the Superfund pipeline stage that begins with the discovery of a site and then ends with its final completion, what we think optimization looks like in each of those separate stages. I'm moving on now to slide 5. We have with us today myself. I am a co-national program manager for the National Optimization Strategy. I work in headquarters in the Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division. And today we have with us Steve Diamond, my co-worker there in, my associate in TIFSD, who is very familiar with the investigation stage optimizations, highly proficient in that. Doug Sutton with Tetra Tech. Doug has done about, probably 100-plus optimizations on his own and has been working with us for the past 12 years. Mindy Vanderford also has participated in a very, very large number of those. I'm not sure exactly what her number is, but she has been a major contributor to all of these optimizations, which we've been doing for the past 15 years. Let's move on to slide number 6. We're looking now at the national strategy and the optimization evaluation process. In slide 7, let me just say that optimization is not a new thing for EPA and for Superfund. We have 13-plus years of optimizations under our belt with about 140 or an expanding number of reviews conducted. So there's a lot of information, a lot of work that's gone into this. We heard from, we were asked to brief our upper management, that would be the assistant administrator and the deputy assistant administrator, on our efforts over the past 15 years or so, 13 to 15. They liked it very, very much. They said, please make a national program out of this. This is doing great stuff. So we had a directive then to expand optimization efforts and integrate those into the program activities, that being sort of the day-to-day program activities of Superfund, from RI to site completion. We worked for a couple of years on that. The strategy was finalized in September of last year, and we are now in full implementation of that strategy. It was also part of the Integrated Cleanup Initiative. You may not be familiar with that, but that was a special initiative to attempt to get greater efficiencies out of the Superfund program. Very successful, produced a lot of recommendations. If you haven't, if you aren't aware of that, then you can look it up. If you just Google Integrated Cleanup Initiative, you're going to be able to find that. There's a website there. Let's look at slide number 8, in which we look at our basic working definition of optimization. This is a sort of a shorter version than the one that's in the strategy, which is on my next slide, but it's a systematic site review by a team of independent technical experts. The independent part of that is really very important. At any phase or cleanup process, that would be from the beginning to the end of the process, to identify opportunities to improve remedy protectiveness. Of course, that is the key question of Superfund remedies, is their protectiveness and the main reason why we do them. The effectiveness of those remedies, and that is, are they working as they intend or are intended to work, and is the likelihood of reaching the objectives, the remedial action objectives of the site, going to be served by what's going on there? And then in the cost efficiency areas, that is extremely important to all of us these days in Superfund. I'm sure that none of us have missed the sequestration diet that we're all on now and the significant cuts that are demanded by sequestration both this year and potentially in future and upcoming years. So cost efficiency is very key. And then bringing that site to completion, the question of what is the site going to be after it's finished being a Superfund site. Let's turn to slide 9 and look at the national strategy discussion. That expands on this in certain ways, that definition, the working definition, and talks more about improving the remedies protectiveness, the use of a systematic site review by a team of independent technical experts. We've already talked about that. Principles from green remediation, we've added those now to each of the optimization technical supports, either qualitative or a quantitative assessment of the possibilities of footprint reduction, or the use of, for example, Triad. That would be the use of those three powerful tools together. This goes on to say as well, that contractors, states, tribes, and the public and PRPs are encouraged to put forth opportunities for the agency to consider. On slide 10, we are looking at unifying methods, because all of the methods that we currently use, or most of them, are are long worked, and that is, and they were freestanding before. Now we've gathered them under the singular term optimization. That's triad, high-resolution site characterization, and the like. Independent design reviews, a lot like value engineering. Remedial system evaluations, which are a whole holistic look at the site and the various artifacts that have come from the remediation process. Long-term monitoring optimization oftentimes develops looking at the well fields, assessing their effectiveness, and of course, green remediation. Rationale here is to eliminate redundant activities, removing technical barriers, leveraging the best management practices that we've all identified over these many years, simplifying the whole process of optimization and improving the support to the regions, increasing technical resource access, and enhancing capabilities to conduct that technical transfer. Let's go to slide 11. This just is a slide which quickly depicts both the pipeline stages and each of where optimization plays in that, and also the key optimization components, looking at the exit strategy, remedy components, monitoring, the use of triad, data management, a key portion that we'll be talking about later, green remediation, and of course the CSM being one of the primary drivers for all of those things. Looking at slide 12, we see that there is a very broad applicability of optimization. We've done these optimizations at virtually every site type and many, many, many types of remedies. And this is simply a recounting of some of those types of remedies that have been evaluated and some of the types of sites. Key point back there on slide 12 is that optimization can be applied to all sites and remedy types. And in slide 13, we're looking at the national optimization strategy that I mentioned. Several components, expand optimization to more Superfund remedial sites to 20 to 30 per year. You'll see that we are exceeding that presently in one of the following slides. Expanding efforts earlier into the pipeline, the use of the various tools, it leverages regional and also ready resources by combining the power of those resources together. Helps to develop regional optimization programs and expertise through a training program, which is under development. And it also tracks results for all sites and all recommendations for a several-year period to determine their implementation and how that has gone for them. On slide 14, the strategy once again was signed in September, distributed in October of last year. The four elements: planning and outreach, integration and training, implementation and measurement, I've just spoken of. We developed it by a national work group led by the headquarters group, not myself most specifically. It included key Superfund headquarters resources and regional work group members. We also have regional liaisons for each of those work groups, for each of those regions now, and those persons are becoming increasingly aware of and familiar with optimization principles and practices. We report to the Leadership Steering Committee here in headquarters, and we post reports on both Clurian and EPA websites. Let's look at slide 15 and see what kinds of activities we've been doing this way recently. We finalized the strategy. Last year, we supported optimization of 32 sites, so we're meeting our targets there. Currently, we're supporting optimization of 34 sites. We're meeting our target this year. We have been tracking completing reported sites. We produce a listing of recommendations and their status in the Groundwater Remedy Optimization Progress Report for 2010-2011, produced in July of 2012. We'll produce another of those this year. If you want to find that, there are links towards the end of this presentation that steer you to those reports if you are interested in seeing the several reports that we have produced so far. We're incorporating optimization into contracts and guidance as appropriate, and we're under development with the training program that has taken a little bit of a backseat, but now is reaching prominence as we put some of the other procedures and processes into place. And we have a mining sites initiative where we've been asked to take a look at 10 mining sites this year as part of our optimization repertoire. And then develop lessons learned from those to see if we can make some headway with these very daunting sites. The next slide, 16, shows you the two key EPA optimization websites. I'm about to launch a new web page on CLUIN, which will join the two current web pages into one single page. The right side of your screen there, you will see the link for the EPA.gov Superfund cleanup post-construction optimization page. Now, performing an optimization evaluation, what do we do? How does one request those? Well, first of all, there's a site identification and selection. That's done presently on a first-come, first-served basis, and we are heading towards region comes in and the regional project manager asks for an optimization. So far, we've been able to provide that optimization to them. We are now making sure that we notify headquarters and regional management that we are in town, that we are doing this, and that get them on board for that process. To initiate an optimization evaluation, an RPM or a section chief or a branch chief may call the headquarters contact. That would be me. Regional management, as I mentioned, will call perhaps. But a state may request. If a state wants to call me, that's fine. Of course, we would vet that completely through the region and make sure that the region was completely okay with that. And we are now possibly going to be focusing more on fund lead sites, both federal and state lead, because we're doing an assessment that I'll talk about a little bit later. And we developed an internal EPA standard operating procedure that is nearly complete and will soon be available. That's a headquarters internal document, but I'll be sharing that with my regional liaisons and contacts. That is really not an external document, but it basically says how we do things internally and how we coordinate. So the headquarters optimization leads, we have a team now. It was a very small startup group earlier, but now we have a number of people who have been volunteering because, of course, this is an important initiative, and this is a list of those names on page 19. And how to get in touch with those people, you can just give any of us a jingle through the email, let us know that you have an interest or a question, and then we will respond. Here are the regional optimization liaisons I mentioned. There are some of these people who are actually Superfund technical liaisons, which are portions of the Office of Research and Development assigned to each of the regions to assist in Superfund. Now, slides 21, that now comes to the point where I'm going to begin turning it over first to Steve, and then to Doug, and then to Mindy, respectively, with questions after each component to talk about what happens to optimization in the Superfund pipeline stages. Just to lead into Steve's presentation, let me just say that the typical, on page 22, you see the typical evaluation process. There's a kickoff, or we do a conflict of interest to make sure that there isn't any conflicts on anybody's part to conduct the project. We then do site meeting after a conference called Scope the Project, and interviews of the stakeholders, and a very big back and forth exchange on what really ought to be done. There's a document data review and evaluation. That's first a document exchange. ROD, RD, borne logs, well concentrations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Those are evaluated after the site visit in about 30 to 45 days, 60 days for the longer ones. We then produce a draft report with draft findings. That report is vetted, commented on by all stakeholders, including the PRPs if they're participating with us, if those PRPs are willing and able to help. And then we will produce a revised report with recommendations, findings and recommendations, a final report, and then that goes into recommendation tracking. And more often than not, unless it's enforcement sensitive, will be posted on the Cleveland website so that all may see the results. With that, let me move along now to slide 23, and I'm going to turn that over to Steve to talk about optimization during the investigation stage. Steve, are you ready to go?
Yes, I am. Thanks, Kirby.
Okay, thanks. I'll turn it over to you then.
Great. All right. Well, as Kirby mentioned, the Superfund program's been doing optimizations for more than 13 years, and I'm going to be talking about kind of the new kid on the block in terms of how long we've been doing optimizations for the front end of the pipeline, the Superfund pipeline. So we'll be going in the opposite direction, or we'll be going in the direction of the Superfund pipeline, but in terms of the experience that we've had and the number of optimizations we've done, certainly on the front end of the Superfund pipeline are some of the newer ideas and best management practices that we've been developing over the last few years. In fact, if you just refer back to slide 12, just take a peek at slide 12, and you look at some of those types of sites early on in the optimization process, we were very much focused on long-term monitoring optimization, so long-term response action, LTRA, as well, with a focus on Superfund lead pump and treat systems. Of course, since that time, we started to, over the years, started to move into other site types, not just pump and treat systems, but soil remedies, mining sites, and so on and so forth, different types of remedial technologies beyond the traditional pump and treat systems into in situ technologies and so on, and it's really expanded from there. In the last few years, what we've done is to try to take a lot of the lessons learned from the earlier process, the earlier optimization efforts, and try to move those up the Superfund pipeline to see if we can gain some efficiencies to really help out with how our remedies are performing. So it was around, 2005. I came to the agency in 2005, and around that time we actually did a small study of optimization sites that had been done, again, mostly independent design review and long-term monitoring optimization or long-term remedial action type optimization reviews, where we looked at the attributes of 52 sites that had been undergone the optimization review process, and then we aggregated the attributes of those. And some of the findings that were of interest, of course, for those sites, 83% of those sites we found opportunities for cost savings. In fact, at 52% of those sites, the potential cost savings exceeded $1 million. About 19% of those sites we either eliminated or confirmed no exposure pathways for ecological risk. Similarly, about 33% of those sites we eliminated or confirmed no exposure for human health receptors as well. And about 62% of those sites we either improved or confirmed plume controls, i.e. plume, both delineation and capture for pump and treat systems, for about 62% of those sites. But when I came to the agency, the number that jumped out at me was the fact that about 45%, almost 50% of the optimization sites that we looked at, the 52 that we looked at, also had recommendations for improvements to the conceptual site model or the need for additional characterization. Now remember, these are sites that are pretty far down the pipeline, and we're really in the remediation stage, but we're finding issues with either the conceptual site model, missed source areas, the need for additional characterization, and so on. So this is really kind of where we started to apply, at the time, a lot of our best management practices like the efforts of TRIAD and high-resolution site characterization and things of those nature. Of course, enter the 2013 National Optimization Strategy, along with significant management support for moving up optimization through the pipeline to really try to gain some of those efficiencies. So we're talking about, you know, something where remediation can cost significantly more than what characterization costs. The idea is to try to do a good job with characterization and use all the tools and best management practices at our disposal with the hopes of gaining both efficiencies and cost savings for our remedial efforts. So back to, sorry, I gotta get my slide here. Slide 23. So we define optimization during the investigation stage essentially as any part of the remedial process prior to the remedy being selected. So in the Superfund program, this is our record of decision, our ROD, where we select a remedy. So the focus of the next few slides here for the optimization during investigation stage covers that. Let's move to slide 24. So historically, what have we typically reviewed? Again, we've been able to take advantage of our experience with programs like Triad, systematic planning, dynamic work strategies, and real-time measurement technologies, bringing those things together to improve our conceptual site models, do a better job of characterization and delineation, taking advantage of all the new and exciting tools that that we have. So typically when we do an optimization review at this stage of the Superfund pipeline, we're really focused on the conceptual site model. That's a huge piece. We really want to try to look at all the historical information and data. And regardless of where we are in the pipeline, there's usually a significant amount of information in the early stages. And that's why we're there. We know something about the site. We know something about the releases that have happened or the historical operations and so on. And that's really why the Superfund program is there. So there's a tremendous amount of information both that the agency has or that we can access that can provide significant value in terms of initial development of a conceptual site model. And the types of things that we typically look at are the types of things that people would look at for most types of site investigations. We want to know about geology, both at the site, to some extent regionally. We certainly want to know hydrogeology, chemistry, something about the historical operations, and that's a great example of being able to leverage existing information. We do a lot of work at manufactured gas plants, for example, and we can look at productivity and production rates for the manufactured gas plant in its peak years and look at the volumes that they were working with and decide, have we found all those tank holder bottoms? You know, if we only found two and those can hold 500,000 gallons each, and we know at their capacity they were producing 2 or 3 million, then they were probably, as part of our investigation, would be looking for additional tank holders. So there's lots of historical information that we can get our hands on. The other thing we'll look at is we're going to look at data quality and its usability and sort of the net information value, but I would argue that almost all information has value, particularly in light of changing project managers or contractors. I know in my personal experience, we've gone to sites to do optimization reviews and heard things like, well, that was contractor X and we're contractor Y, so we're not comfortable with the data they collected 2 years ago, and I see a lot of sort of continuing to collect the same data over and over and really trying to avoid that as much as possible and use the existing information by doing a thorough analysis in terms of its data quality and usability, but then incorporating that into our assessment of data gaps. Another thing we'll look at is whether or not they've done 3D visualization and analyses, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes. Again, the focus is the conceptual site model and how that conceptual site model aligns with the project life cycle. In fact, if you go on CLUIN, our office produced a document about the conceptual site model, project life cycle, which I think better describes a lot of the sort of concepts that I'll be talking about in the next few minutes. So I would encourage you to look on CLUIN. I think if you search for conceptual site model, project life cycle, that technical memorandum should, or that that technical document should pop up. And it's relatively short and an easy read, but it's meant to sort of steer folks towards this idea of using the conceptual site model rather as, you know, rather than something that we have to produce at the beginning and then put on a shelf and never use again, really taking advantage of what the conceptual site model can offer a project technical team and its stakeholders in terms of its ability to help us manage our sites and make decisions. So we're looking at how well have they done plume delineation. Do we know where those plume cores are and those migration pathways? Have we really done a good job with looking at those things? If you look at the literature and other things out there in terms of plume cores, for example, and the work that's been going on in the arena of mass flux, there's lots of literature out there that says something along the lines of, you know, 80 or 90% of our mass moving through something like 10 or 15% of a cross-sectional area. And perhaps with some of our traditional tools, we may have been missing some of those plume cores or those key migration pathways, and that can really affect our ability to be successful in remediation. So a great conceptual site model typically leads to good success in remediation, and where we have problems with our conceptual site model, we tend to find challenges with our remediation. So terms of source identification, have we found all of our sources? And by sources, I mean both your traditional source areas, but also your secondary source areas, those areas that may have been contaminated by the release and are now holding mass. Tighter fine grain materials, for example, that can capture a lot of mass and then hold on to that mass and through the process of bleed out that mass over significant periods of time, creating challenges for us in terms of our dissolve phase plumes that we have to address. But we also look at technologies that have been applied there in terms of the analytical tools they've used, the sampling and measurement tools that they've used. Have they been using field analytics? Have they been using traditional laboratory methods? How do we blend those to get the maximum value from what each of those technologies can offer? But we also look at stakeholder needs, and this is something that a best management practice that came out of our efforts with Triad and our systematic planning efforts, and that is understanding what our partners need, what our states and regional partners need to be able to address these sites. And that leads me to the last point on slide 24, the idea of the idea of exit strategies and considerations for exit strategies. Let's move to slide 25, and I've tried to illustrate kind of what what we've been thinking about in the Superfund program in terms of a comprehensive exit strategy design. So what you're looking at here on your left are project types, and this is for a variety of types of organizations or sites, but you typically have either a single site or a portfolio of sites, and the design and considerations for your exit strategy would be significantly different from, say, a single site versus multiple sites. So if you think about an organization that has multiple sites, for example, a DOD facility, someone like the Air Force who has said we're going to have all remedies in place by 2015 or 2020, whatever the date is these days, or single sites, whether you're dealing with a single gas station or something along those lines. There can be significant differences in development and need for an exit strategy based on that type of project type. Similarly, from a strategy level perspective, we've traditionally focused on the technical and media, and with good reason. When in terms of thinking about our exit strategies, we traditionally focus on the technical and media issues, which are, you know, will the technology that we are applying, will that be able to meet our cleanup goals, or do we need a combination of technologies? What time frames are we looking for? How will it perform in different media? That's where we've traditionally spent a lot of our time in terms of thinking about exit strategies. But there are lots of other organizational and programmatic needs, administrative needs, or specific needs of our stakeholders, our state partners, our responsible parties, the public, and those sorts of groups. We have to be able to address all of their data needs, all of their concerns, or we're left with significant uncertainty or roadblocks to moving the site ahead. But ultimately, if we can get through all those sort of strategy levels and do a strategy gap assessment, we can develop a comprehensive exit strategy. And this is something that the Superfund program is really starting to take a hard look at. In fact, we've got a Superfund work group developing exit strategy guidance for the program, which draws upon a lot of existing guidance, but the idea is to help our RPMs navigate all of these different strategy levels, make sure that we're hitting all of the important pieces that we need to be able to get to an endpoint. I've been talking about exit strategies for a couple of years now, and I know folks in the Department of Defense and other agencies have been as well. So much so that at the Federal Remediation Technology Roundtable last year, I gave a talk on optimization and the opportunities that optimization provides to develop a comprehensive exit strategy. Particularly when you're looking at sites in the later stages of optimization, there's a real need, and this was obviously identified by the Superfund work group that's now working on these development of these exit strategies, to try to make sure we can navigate those remaining organizational, programmatic, or stakeholder concerns to get us to a decision, and ultimately to be able to achieve our remediation goals and move the site off of the NPL. One of the things I looked at was definitions for exit strategy, and there are many, but I thought there were a couple that were sort of interesting. Method or plan for extricating oneself from an undesirable situation. Another was a plan and timetable for withdrawal from a military engagement. And the third one was a method by which an investor intends to cash out of an investment. So I think probably that first one applies probably greatest to the Superfund program, a method or plan for extricating oneself from an undesirable situation. And this doesn't just exist for EPA. This exists for our state counterparts, our responsible parties, our consultants and others who are trying to work through these processes. Nobody wants to get to a point where we're stuck in terms of what do we do next or how do we address this site. We really want to try to avoid that situation by looking ahead, deciding where we want to be, and then designing that exit strategy to address all the organizational, programmatic, stakeholder, technical, and administrative needs to get us there. And we're working on that now in the Superfund program. I think it's exciting and it's important. Let's move to slide 26. A typical, frequent review findings that we find in our optimization reviews in the early stages, in the RIFS stages, numerous prior data collection efforts. So these are a lot of the work that's been done. This is all that existing information that I think we can take better advantage of than we have perhaps traditionally. Some of the other frequent review findings that we see are low data density, high analytical quality of that data, but the low data density is leading us to a great spatial uncertainty. And the higher the greater that uncertainty is, that's what's driving our ability to make decisions. So high uncertainty equals no decision. So we have to be able to squash our uncertainties to the point where our decision makers are comfortable making decisions about technologies we're going to apply and action levels and other things, or ARARs or other things that we're going to be able to achieve. another frequent findings are existing data is not fully leveraged. This is the development of the conceptual site model. And I would encourage everyone to look at that life cycle concept, really build up your conceptual site models much more than the traditional pathway receptor network diagrams that have been shown in some of the guidances. Those are key components of a conceptual site model, but in and of themselves are pretty simplistic, and they don't provide information, spatial information, or temporal information, or information about mass and volume and what we're dealing with at some of these sites. You don't get that from a pathway receptor network diagram, which simply shows receptors and potential ways that contamination might move through certain media, which again is important from a risk standpoint, trying to figure out, you know, who are receptors and who might be at risk. Certainly a part of a conceptual site model, but at least in my opinion, somewhat inadequate to really cover all of the bases of what a conceptual site model can do for us. In terms of strategy and technologies that we typically find during our reviews, we find the perhaps more static applications of characterization, what we lovingly refer to in some cases as poke and hope, where we're looking at our monitoring well network, and then, you know, there's always the one or two people say, oh, if we just put one more well over there, we're really going to have this site nailed down. We put a well over there, and lo and behold, what do we find? A new source area or something that was unexpected, and it just moves the whole project back. So we're really after, to the extent we can, taking advantage of the use of some of the triad elements like dynamic work strategies and like high-resolution site characterization to get at both the issue of the scale of measurement versus the scale of heterogeneity, but also just density, data density. And our traditional methods, while high cost, have been less dense because we are, say, using monitoring wells solely for investigation purposes. Monitoring wells are great tools for monitoring and can be important parts of our investigation toolbox, but in and of themselves may not be the only thing that you may want to try at your site. We have a lot of direct sensing tools and other things that are available to us, things like membrane interface probe and laser-induced fluorescence that can provide really dense data sets, which when used in conjunction with our more traditional methods can provide that collaborative data set that can really increase the confidence that we have in our conceptual site model and ultimately our success in remediation. In terms of decision ability, one of our findings is that the end data users are not always adequately considered. So here I'm thinking of our risk assessment folks or other stakeholders who are going to have to use this data to make a decision. And oftentimes we find that they're brought in late in the process, handed a messy data set, and then being asked to make a decision. What we try to do through our optimization efforts, particularly on the front end of the Superfund pipeline, is get those folks involved early, get our risk assessment folks involved early, so that we can understand things like challenges with background and bioavailability in terms of metals at mining sites. You know, if we don't address a lot of those things early, what ends up happening is we collect a lot of data and then hope the data tells us what we need to do in terms of, you know, bioavailability or how we should treat background and others. And there's processes and reasons for doing some of that, but to the extent we can, follow the Superfund process and at least be considering those issues earlier, we find great efficiencies and success in doing that. Let's move to slide 27. Again, typical or frequent optimization recommendations. These are based on the number of sites that we've done optimization for in the RIFS process. Systematic project planning and best practices. Systematic project planning, of course, is something that most folks would do, whether they follow the EPA's DQO process or some other process. Most folks would say, yes, I do planning for my sites. I think what we are suggesting here is that a more comprehensive systematic planning and scoping effort really be used to improve our ability to navigate the RIFS process, develop a good strategy for a record of decision, and develop a good strategy for remediation. So we're talking not only about following the data quality objectives process, which perhaps traditionally has been really focused on the analytical pieces, but thinking about all those other exit strategy components like our stakeholders, our organizational and administrative and data needs to navigate a complex program like Superfund. And also incorporating best practices. Best practices, of course, are any number of things that we've found over the years to provide opportunities for success in terms of our ability to move through the Superfund process and gain efficiencies in remediation. So thinking in terms of best practices, we're thinking about things like some of the elements of triad, use of a conceptual site model to the extent of possible, using dynamic work strategies and high-resolution site characterization techniques. These are a lot of the best practices that we've identified over the years that I've found to be extremely important in our success. In terms of other types of frequent optimization recommendations, improving the conceptual site model using existing data. In fact, one of the first things we'll do under this process is take a look at the conceptual site model, if it exists, from a site, and really help our project managers leverage all that existing information and then use that CSM as a way to design our investigations going forward. And how we do that is we use the conceptual site model to identify data gaps. In some cases, we have no data where we think we need data, be it spatial or temporal. In other cases, we may not have significant confidence in the data that we have, and we may want to augment that data set. So that's really what we're looking at, is what data do we have, what is our CSM telling us, and what are we comfortable with and what are we not comfortable with in terms of moving forward? Because remember, it's that uncertainty that's going to limit our ability to make decisions. And when we limit our ability to make decisions, we drag the process out, increasing cost and time and other things. So we're really trying to avoid that. Next one, using high-resolution site characterization methods, is we've got a new course on that now. We're going out to the EPA regions, and both our EPA regional folks and RAC contractors and others have been able to access this training. I would encourage you to look for opportunities for that, both on CLUIN and TrainX, our training website. Of course, if you're able to take advantage of those types of technologies, which I think most of our savvy project managers are these days, you really want to consider something like a demonstration of the method's applicability that is sort of a look at not only whether or not the technology will work and how it will work with your media and your particular matrix that you have at your site, but how are you going to use that information collaboratively with other data sources? So if you think about, for example, a metal site, X-ray fluorescence is a well-known, well-understood tool, can be super valuable in terms of its ability to provide a lot of information cost-effectively on metals concentrations and the extent of contamination from metals. But how do we use that XRF? Do we need to dry the samples? Do we need to grind the samples to a uniform particle size? you know, how are we using it to make decisions? Are we using point measurements? Are we looking at an incremental or compositing design to try to get an understanding of a mean concentration within a decision unit? And then how are we going to use that information collaboratively with our lab, our typical or more traditional laboratory technologies, like in the case of metals, an inductively coupled plasma, or like a 6200 or 6000 methods for metals from our laboratory. So we're gonna blend those two data sets in a way that gives us confidence both in terms of managing spatial variability, but also managing analytical variability, which we've traditionally focused on, perhaps to the detriment of some of the other challenges like spatial variability and matrix heterogeneity. Also, we find that one of the things that we are usually recommending is the use of a dynamic work strategy, something that that's been embodied and been used in Triad for, you know, more than a decade. Of course, to be able to use that dynamic work strategy, we need to be able to use real-time measurement technologies. So we have to have something that can provide information in a time frame that allows us to make decisions in the field, and then use that for things like stepping out, delineations, deciding when a laboratory sample or confirmation or collaborative boring might be necessary, for example. And then we want to sequence those field efforts to maximize information and resources, and generally we do that by starting with less intrusive and moving to more intrusive methodologies. So nailing down what we know about our geology and our hydrogeology through less intrusive methods like geophysics and other things, and then transitioning what we learn from those sequence of activities to our more intrusive either direct sensing tools or more traditional borings and sample collection as well. The idea is to use the symptoms to find the disease as a doctor would, perhaps, which is a little bit different than what we've done in the industry traditionally, which is search for sources. What we're suggesting in the high-resolution site characterization course and others is to use where we find contamination and look at that contamination at a relatively high density vertically in particular, and then try to use that information through a combination of high-resolution vertical and transects, for example, to then determine the plume cores and try to vector back to source areas. So it's can be a little bit different than perhaps people have been thinking about these sites traditionally, where we know there's a source out there, we don't know where it is, and we're going to use more of a poke and hope type strategy to go after that. Or do we use the information we have, the symptoms that we see at our site, to see if we can figure out which organ has the disease? And that's really what we're trying to move the Superfund program more in that direction as well. And then finally, planning for and collecting collaborative data. That's the combining different technologies to take advantage of what they do for us in terms of their analytical detection limits and analyte specificity, but then combining that with some of our cheaper, more rapid, and to some extent perhaps less precise instrumentation, but still provides tremendous value in terms of understanding our conceptual site model, where contamination is or isn't, and so on. And then finally, something that we've been doing a lot more of in the last few years is taking advantage of the new tools that are out there in terms of 3D visualization and analysis. We can look at site data, we can have tremendous discussions amongst our technical teams and others, and then also use those tools to communicate with our stakeholders and also maintain consensus about what we think we know about the site, where we have concerns, and so on. So the 3D visualization analysis tools have come a long way and are really starting to provide us great efficiencies in the Superfund program, and it's an exciting new area that we've been working with over the last couple of years. And then finally, green remediation. And something that we'll look at in terms of our frequent recommendations is looking at the environmental footprint of our investigation efforts. What can we do to limit investigation-derived waste or manage our site in a means that lowers our footprint for the characterization phase? And that's really the gist of the typical optimization findings that we have. And again, as Kirby mentioned at the top of the talk, we'll be providing much more specifics in terms of how something like an optimization review in the remedial investigation feasibility phase works, and we'll be showing you the Black Butte Mine RIFS optimization next Wednesday in part two. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Kirby.
Thank you, Steve. Kirby, very much to Jean. Did you have a comment, Jean?
Yeah, sorry, Kirby. I wanted to make sure we could take a quick break to do a couple of questions. that have come in.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Sounds
so
like
Kirby, I'm going to go through a couple of questions. We had one general question asking about lessons that we've learned over the 13 years of optimization work. And Steve, I think you just did a great job summarizing that one. So I want to jump forward just a simple question. I had a participant from Arlington, Virginia, who wanted you to remind them what some of the acronyms that you used earlier on, such as IDR and LDFO, stand for.
Sorry about that. Yeah, of course. Well, TRAD, I think Steve explained that, but independent design review is a term that we use where we go to do an optimization at the design stage. More often, that's not actually a full report. It is instead a technical memoranda, or perhaps a series of technical memoranda, because I think, as we all recognize, when one is beginning the design, one is chasing the tail of the dog for a while. So it's not like everything is all set. It's been working. It's very much like value engineering, if anyone has ever been involved in that. That's a very holistic look at the proposed remedial action and whether or not at the design stage it's being designed to meet the objectives in question. The remedial system evaluation is a look at the remedial action stage. Usually the remedy has been in, it's been operating, it could be getting close to completion, and we are looking at legacy components of that to make sure that it's all working together properly, because sometimes those can become disjointed. LTMO is long-term monitoring optimization. That is more often than not applied to operating monitoring networks and systems, and may involve looking using analytical tools such as the Morrow software. That's the monitoring remedial operations software produced by GSI, and that looks at the efficacy, efficiency, and relative contributions of the various individual wells in the field, and oftentimes can result in a reduction in either sampling or monitoring frequency. May require the addition of new wells to ensure that the plume is fully delineated and that information is captured.
Okay, great. We have another participant who would like to know if you could talk a little bit about states and their involvement in optimization. So they specifically go on to ask, are any states doing their own optimization program? And then they're also looking to see if you can perhaps comment on when it's time to transfer a site from EPA lead over to a state leading the cleanup. What role does optimization play in that process?
Okay. Yes, we actually engage with our state counterparts and shareholders in the optimization process. The state is almost always involved, and I'm talking about deeply involved as a team member. We think that that's good and important to have all of the stakeholders there, because if you've been a participant, you know how the process goes. You can be bought in. Whereas if you're outside of that process, you can sometimes feel excluded and left out and not knowing what's going on. With respect to state programs, I would invite people to let me know if there are actually ongoing state program optimization efforts. I am not sure whether there are such things. I feel pretty sure there are. I'm also the project officer for Interstate Technology Regulatory Council, and I'm actually in Montgomery, Alabama today, sitting with some of those teams. They produce several monitor optimization documents by states for states several years back, and are talking about the potential for adding some of that into some of the other work. For example, the Groundwater Statistics and Monitoring Team is adding optimization as a key component of that, looking at LTMO that I just mentioned. So I would invite any state to let me know. Did that answer the question for you, Gene?
I think you did
okay.
A great job.
Steve,
we have a couple of questions for you, and the first one is in reference to slide number 25, where you sort of had an idealized exit strategy diagram. In reference to slide number 25, this participant would like to know if when you use the phrase site or sites, are you including OUs in that concept, or are you talking about the complete whole site together?
It can be broken up into OUs or a whole site. I think at least initially, and again, this is a sort of a concept that, we've been talking about within the agency. It's not sort of any formalized picture or anything that that we're going to put out there as guidance. But the idea with the exit strategy design is to sort of capture, I guess, those two extremes. So whether you're looking at a single OU or whether you're looking at multiple OUs or you know, multiple OUs for multiple sites. So I think the top version, the multiple sites, is really like some of our military installations or some of our federal facilities that have, you know, many areas of concern, multiple OUs, or a single site, which could be broken up into, you know, a groundwater OU and a soil OU. And if that is the case, I would develop exit strategies on an OU basis, perhaps, particularly when you're talking about groundwater. So a lot of our sites in the Superfund program, we've had great successes in soil media, and then we're left with more of a long-term cleanup because groundwater is a little more complex and cleanup can be more challenging and take more time, that we would deal with that OU on a different time scale and probably have a different exit strategy for that. Typically what we've seen is, you know, if you're going to do removal or something, we can usually address source materials or soils in a time frame that's different from what it might take us to achieve our groundwater cleanup objectives. So in that case, I'd be looking at it on an OU basis. And in fact, you'd have different strategies for your groundwater OU in terms of our administrative needs and some of our programmatic or organizational needs. Certainly our technical needs, we're going to have different issues for a groundwater OU than we might have for a soil OU, for example.
Okay. Let's try to squeeze in one more question before we carry on. And this one comes in from Fredericksburg, Virginia. Steve, this is also directed at you. And they would like to know if you can please expand upon the difference between the 3D visualization and the traditional method of drilling and using laboratory results.
Okay. Well, they can actually be used together. What I think the point about the what I was lovingly referring to as poke and hope and the more traditional methods are, you know, we still are using those and we are still encouraging folks to use those methodologies. What we are encouraging them also to do, though, is use those collaboratively with a lot of the new tools, like the direct sensing tools and others. And so that's really kind of where we're going with it. Traditionally, what we've done is we haven't had some of these tools that have come along in, say, the last 10 or 15 years. And ultimately, most sites need a monitoring network, and we've used monitoring wells as an investigation tool. And the problem with that can be that we are putting in wells that may not be put in the most optimum place spatially. We're screening those wells, perhaps not in a location that is optimal in terms of our screen interval, or worse, screening across very different intervals, so using large screens when we have very discrete migration pathways that we can pick up with some of our direct sensing tools on the order of inches or feet, where, you know, a 20 or 30-foot well screen would obscure that. In our high-resolution site characterization course, we talk about something called depth-integrated flow-weighted averaging. It's a mouthful of a term, but essentially what happens is, in a lot of these situations, you have, within a single well screen, and say at a chlorinated solvent site, you have a mixing of high-concentration, low-flow zones with low-concentration, high-flow zones. And we can show this over and over again. We'll drop a well co-located right next to a direct push where we're using a tool like a profiling system, like the Waterloo Profiler, for example. And we can show, you know, orders of magnitude, in some cases 6 or 7 orders of magnitude difference across just, you know, a few feet or inches in terms of the concentration of what we're finding. But then those concentrations are typically embedded in different types of aquifer materials. So a high concentration from a low flow, tighter, lower hydraulic conductivity unit would mix with a high flow, say, sand or gravel, and then we get sort of an average concentration within that well screen. And that can be okay for monitoring and some of our other data needs, but particularly when you're going to move into design for remediation systems, those can be very misleading. In fact, we've seen examples where we've designed passive reactive barriers, for example, with a resonance time expecting a concentration of 2,000 parts per billion, and we have concentrations going through there at 60 or 70 or 80,000, right next to other concentrations that are 200. So this is the challenge with trying to apply remediation on a scale that fate and transport works with a water sampling method, which is really born out of the water production world of, you know, aquifer management.
Okay, great.
Thanks, Steve. Gene, are there further questions? If so, I would really like to hold those because I'm afraid we're starting to eat into the next presentations.
Yep, so, I think let's hold them and carry on with the talks.
Okay. So the next step is design optimization during the design and remedy stages. And Doug Sutton, one of my favorite guys, is going to help us out with this. Doug, let me turn that over to you, and you can run us through these slides, and then we'll continue.
Great. Thank you very much, Kirby. I'm going to be talking about the optimization during the design and remedy stages. But what I mean by that is the point from which the remedy is selected through the construction and maybe the initial implementation of the remedy. So we want a rod in place for this kind of phase of optimization. And we can go up through, you know, even construction, maybe the turning on of, say, a remedial system. Maybe that those first several months of operation, you're going to learn a lot and kind of troubleshoot things out. And this type or this phase of optimization would apply during this phase and in the time frame I'm talking about. So let's move on to slide number 29 and talk about why you might do optimization during this particular phase of a project. And number one is that a stakeholder or the site manager himself may have concerns about the protectiveness of the remedy or the design or the costs. And that would be that's one of the largest reasons why we see these sites getting nominated is either concern about protectiveness or concern about cost. Now, of those, there are different subsets associated with that. For example, there may be concerns about the CSM. And, of course, if you have concerns about the CSM, you might be concerned about either the protectiveness or the cost. It usually leads to one of those two things. And the concerns about a CSM could be recognizing, you know, the site manager or a stakeholder recognizing that they actually just don't have one. They've got a lot of data but haven't really put it together into a nice pack, understandable package. Or that they know they've got data gaps and they're not sure whether those data gaps are critical or not critical. I mean, ultimately, you're always going to have data gaps. It's just a matter of which ones are critical for having a robust design. Then there's also, given the cost of remedies in our business, there's always the lookout for innovative remedial approaches. Sometimes there's quite a few people out there looking for silver bullets, and obviously if we had a silver bullet, then we would have shown it to everybody by now. But that doesn't mean that we can't help you find a better way of implementing either an innovative technology or an existing technology in a better way to help you reduce your cost, your protectiveness. And certainly, given the number of sites that we go to and the number of parties that we interact with, we get a pretty good handle on what's out there, what's successful, what are some of the limitations and things like that, and it's a good opportunity to cross-pollinate against site teams that we run into. Another reason why someone might choose to have optimization done at their site at this stage is a difference among members of the site team. You know, when you hit design, that's where a lot of the details start to come out. It's one thing to select a remedy with fairly broad brushes. It's another thing to start to get into the details of what you're going to install, where you're going to install it, how often you're going to do it, what have you. So when you start to get to those, what you're going to phase and when you're going to phase it, and those details can often lead to differences of opinion, either within a team or among different stakeholders. So that's a good optimization, or this third-party perspective can help settle, or at least organize the conversation around those differences and help find a common ground. There might be a site manager might have concerns about the findings or conclusions that a site consultant is providing, and they may want a third-party perspective for that. For example, if you did a pilot test of a technology and the consultant comes back and says, yeah, it doesn't look like it worked very well, before abandoning that technology with that conclusion, someone might choose a third-party perspective to take a look at that and see if the same conclusion is reached by the third-party experts. Then there's other things like unexpected monitoring results or test results that happen during the design phase that may generate some interest in optimization. So we'll move on to slide 30 now and talk about what is frequently reviewed. And in a nutshell, what we're out there to do is to provide you meaningful and specific recommendations on what to do with your site during this phase of the remedy and or this stage of the remedial process. And so what we need to do is we need to understand the site in detail. So typically, we ask for everything that's available. And fortunately, these days, most everything is in electronic format, so it's a matter of just transferring large PDF documents and databases and spreadsheets, whereas in the old days, we still asked for everything and got boxes and boxes full of Xerox documents. But we're looking, you know, when we talk about specific documents, we're looking for the RI, you know, remedial investigation and feasibility reports. And when I say that, we're looking for not just the text and the figures, but we're looking for the text, the figures, the tables, the appendices, the boring logs, the sampling, sample logs, all the memos that went along with it, the permits, anything that came along any of those appendices we're looking for, the cost tables, and the feasibility study, we're looking for all that stuff. Certainly we're looking for the decision documents. We're looking for design submittals, like any kind of tech memos that went along with that. We just came back from some sites where we asked to see the compound specific isotope analysis, the modeling memos, what have you. So there's a lot of intermediate documents that we'd like to look at this stage as well. Pilot test results, and not just the pilot test results, but also the pilot test work plans and what was actually done during the pilot test, so that we can interpret the results for ourselves rather than rely on the findings or conclusions of the consultant. We don't want to just know what the end result was, but also how those results were achieved. We may have a different opinion as to what happened during that pilot test, and that difference of opinion could become an important part of the conceptual site model. We also want to look at work plans for future work. Typically, the design process is a very dynamic process, and there will be multiple stages of either pre-design investigation, pilot tests, what have you, and as a result of that, there's work plans for all those different stages, and we'd like to take a look at those to see if, while you're out there, is there additional information that we could suggest that you collect to help provide you the necessary information, or is there money that we can save you by suggesting that something that you might collect might be redundant or unnecessary? We also like to look at implementation reports, especially if we're looking at evaluating a system that's just been constructed and is starting up. We want to see all the things that came along with conducting that or with installing the system. We want to look at the performance monitoring program to see if we can help you get started on a good, constructive, and streamlined performance monitoring program. And any other documents that you as a site team might recognize as important that we haven't had a chance to think about or that might be very site-specific. So moving on to slide 31, what are some of the frequent review findings? And I'm hitting these from a pretty high level. But when you have the part two of this seminar next week, you'll have a chance to see how some specific examples for some specific sites. Some of the findings are that we confirm the work that's been done to date. I mean, in the end, what we come in as a third party is just confirm that the work that's being done is excellent and we fully agree with everything, and that's sometimes a comforting feeling for a site team to have. There's also times that we'll find an incomplete site conceptual model. In fact, I'd make an argument that every conceptual site model is incomplete to some degree, because there's always going to be something that you don't understand or wish you understand. It's just a matter of whether or not you're missing some really critical data gaps that are important for designing a robust remedy. But we'll often find that and suggest some gaps, critical gaps to fill. We might see some inconsistencies in groundwater modeling, whether it's due to inadequate calibration, or whether it's due to just the conceptual model that was used to help develop that model. But we may see some inconsistencies there that need to be worked out before the remedy is designed. Overly generous cost estimates. There's a lot of reasons to have cost estimates, so you can have a nice soft budget so that you have room to work or room to deal with unforeseen circumstances. But in the end, high cost estimates may lead to higher than necessary budgets, and then higher than necessary budgets could lead to higher than necessary expenditures. So we'd like to try to refine those cost estimates and help you refine those cost estimates when the time comes. We also like to look at looking at the data that we get from pilot tests to help better understand our conceptual site model. By the time we come to sites and investigate them, there's an equilibrium out there between the different phases of contamination. There's soils in equilibrium with groundwater and vapor, and groundwater contamination is in equilibrium with soil and whatnot. There's something that's been established over a pretty long period of time. And the one of the ways that you learn a lot about that system and about that conceptual site model is to stress that equilibrium by removing mass or by injecting reagents, things like that, as part of a pilot test that really give you a chance to see how the system reacts. And that's also true with when you install an actual remedy, not just a pilot, but an actual remedy, and you do that in phases. You might have a multi-component remedy with a VIM system, an SVE system, a pump and treat system, all these different things. And the point is, can you do one of those first and learn something from it before you then take that information and design the next component? And so although it becomes a little bit difficult to do in some bureaucratic environments, it is nice to be able to implement things in phases and gain that information from each phase before designing the next one. It could also be true if you're talking about in situ bioremediation injections, where maybe you had a couple biobarriers planned and a source area planned. Well, what can you learn from doing one of those before you do the others? Or whether it's a pump and treat system, you might learn something by putting in the first couple wells before putting in the next ones, and that might help you refine some of your design parameters for the full system down the road. There's also some of our findings is that when we come to the site, we're provided with some unexpected results, whether it's a pilot test that gave something unexpected, or startup results, higher iron in the influent to a treatment plant than was expected, any of these kinds of things. And oftentimes we're able to give our perspective on what that explanation is for those unexpected results. So those are some high-level findings, and like I said, next week we'll provide some more specific examples. Moving on to slide 32, additional findings. Sometimes there's alternative approaches or technologies to do the selected remedy. So, sometimes we want to even come in and suggest alternatives to the selective remedy, but even staying within the bounds of a selective remedy, sometimes there's different things that can be done within that selected remedy, such as if you're doing injections, maybe you've scoped out injection wells, and we might suggest direct push injections, or vice versa. It depends on the site. Sometimes one's more appropriate than the other. Another example might be a prefabricated system versus an on-site building. That would be an example of something that might save you money in one instance, and it's not changing the selected remedy to the rod. It wouldn't require an ESD per se. So that would be another example of things that can be changed and stay within the selected remedy. Treatment and reinjection instead of discharge to a POTW is another example, or using extracted groundwater for blending and injecting your reagents rather than using potable water. Just another example of how you can make suggestions without changing the selected remedy. Moving on to slide 33, we can talk about some frequent recommendations, and these will often follow directly from some of our findings. Refinements to the CSM through additional monitoring or testing. Suggestions for improving numerical modeling, especially if it's critical for the design of the remedy. Suggestions for reducing or streamlining costs and cost estimates. I mentioned before that could be helpful for setting budgets in the future. Phasing remedial components so that later components can benefit from results of earlier phases. I mentioned that also during the findings section. And we actually just came back from doing three optimizations in one of the EPA regions. And a large part of what we focused on, we stayed with the selected remedies. It just came to how do you go about phasing these remedies to gain the information that you want from each of the phases, and also how do you phase the remedies to deal with various constraints that are out there, whether it's constraints brought on by public interest or criticism, or whether it's logistics associated with funding availability, what have you. There's phasing remedies can often help with that. And we spent a lot of time on phasing these particular remedies. And then also looking at considering specific alternative approaches or technologies for that particular site. And with that, I will hand it over, I guess, back to Kirby. And Kirby, you can field the questions for this section and then introduce Mindy when we're done with that.
Sounds perfect. Okay, so Gene, do we have questions here for Doug?
We do indeed. We have a couple of questions that have come in electronically, but before I turn to those, let's just take a quick break to see if anybody on the telephone lines has a question. If you're a phone line participant and haven't been able to submit them electronically, feel free to take yourself off of mute by hitting #6 and identify either your location or organization and then ask your question. Okay. Well, let me turn to some of the online questions, and this first one is coming in from Memphis, Tennessee. And this participant goes on to say that it seems like this process could be contentious, particularly in later stages, as there may be liability involved on the part of the designer, engineer, contractor, etc. What is your experience in this regard?
That's a great question. And I'd say, you know, our history with optimization really started with optimizing pump and treat risk systems that had been operating for years. And that was, you know, that gave us a lot of backup to our recommendations, because we could say that, look, this is how the system, when you stress the system by turning when you stress the aquifer by turning on the system, these are the results you saw. That leads us to this conceptual model, and here's the basis for our recommendations. In that, the listener is absolutely correct. When it comes to the design stage, there's often just differences of opinion, differences of professional opinion. We all have our different expertise. We all have our different exposure to this site or to the particular site or other sites. And yes, it can become somewhat contentious, and the hope is that you work with an optimization team that's done this for a while and can deal with those situations and really try to build consensus rather than create arguments. I will actually say that it can become contentious even without that. I mean, we've gone to some sites before where I remember distinctly walking in, everybody is excited to start with optimization, and it was a while ago, I opened up the conversation with, how about MW9? And it was exactly what the people in the room did not want to hear, but it had to be talked about. And there was silence for a good 10 minutes until we could break the ice and talk about the issues. But yeah, there, optimization, you know, you're bringing a third party to a site that has some people that are very invested in that site, whether it's a project manager, whether it's a consultant. And frankly, you know, people have their turf, their personal investment, their professional investment in these sites, and it's a difficult thing to do. So you just have to have a team that's going to recognize that and try to build consensus. The sites that we just came back from in the region I was just mentioning, there were times when we were just disagreeing with each other on the path forward, but by the end of the meeting, we came to consensus on all three of the sites, and that was three Superfund sites in 1 week, and we came to consensus on all three of them in the path forward. And so it's just a matter of working through those and tackling them in the right direction. But I'd always like to have a lot of data behind my recommendations.
Excellent. We have let
me just add just one little sentence to that, and that is that the objective of optimization, when we do this, it's not in any way a gotcha kind of thing. The objective is to bring everybody together and to put all of these great minds that we have, those people who know the site so well, as well as the independent set of third eyes on this in a collaborative fashion that is designed to move forward and attempt to bring this site to full completion. So even though it does seem like it might be contentious, I think, you know, as we go through, people are clearly and obviously involved in this, and that we are all working on this with the same objective in mind, which is to clean up the site. So I think that usually brings us together, and I personally have not had a lot of static in these. You know, there's sometimes a little discomfort at the beginning, but you know, everybody knows that, you know, we're all there to do the same thing, which is to make everything better. Go ahead.
Thank you so much, Kirby. I appreciate that add-in. We did have another question, though, that came in online And Doug, you had talked about sort of overly generous cost estimates. So I'm seeing some general trends here. People are looking to see how what you're learning from optimization is sort of feeding back into the process. So this attendee wants to know if you've been able to feed input back into cost estimating processes or tools that are used to help improve them so that they're not quite as generous when future calculations are done.
Yeah, I think that optimization is a learning process. We do gather a lot of lessons learned and then forward those to not forward them, but EPA compiles those and every once in a while comes out with quite often comes out with documents that help convey some of those lessons learned. And to say that whether or not that information has been conveyed back into those tools, I don't think it has been yet. I don't think we've put together documents before about cost estimating. There's a document out on Cluin.org about cost estimating and cost-effectively designing systems. But I don't know that any of the tools out there have benefited from those lessons learned or not. I'm not involved in the development of those tools. A lot of cost estimates that we see are based on professional judgment, professional experience, and that's the only support behind a line item. And that those are the ones where you start to see some gravy on top. For example, if you look at a system and you say, okay, well, I've got a carbon, a pump and treat system that's just going to pump through some GAC, and somebody's assuming it's going to be 40 hours of labor per week to handle that, well, that's not necessarily something you'd get out of a cost estimating tool. That might be what the engineer just kind of put in there as a placeholder, and that could very inflate your remedy costs over a life cycle. But those are the kind of things that you can pick up on those things when you're reviewing those cost estimates. Another one would be that if someone's basing carbon usage or reagent usage or any of those kind of things based on kind of the initial concentrations and assuming that same usage over a 10-year period, well, concentration is going to go down over time, so will the materials and chemical usage as well. So in any case, those are just examples of how cost estimates can be maybe generous. Even without the use of a particular tool.
Okay, great.
Well, the questioner does have a very good point, and this is something that we are struggling with as well. Is is there a way that we can offer observations about common cost areas that might potentially be looked at for skinnying down? So we're still. As I mentioned, we're early in the implementation stages, and that is one of the questions that we are now dealing with. Hopefully more to come on that.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Kirby. I think that's the end of the questions that I've got for this portion of the seminar. So I'll go ahead and turn things back to you so we can move on to our next speaker on slide number 34.
Okay, good. This is the long-term remedial action and O&M stages. We're lucky enough to have it today with us, Mindy Vanderford, a longtime associate of myself and the others on the phone. And Mindy is a great statistician, and she's been the developer of some of the key computer models that are oftentimes used to assess the efficacy of operating systems. So, Mindy's with GSI Environmental, and Mindy, let me turn it over to you now.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to briefly discuss optimization during the long-term remedial action and O&M stages. This is roughly the period after you've had construction complete, depending on which part of the program you're in, whether you're federal facilities, fund lead, or PRP lead. These points can trigger at different times, but since about 2001, I've been going in and looking at sites that already had rods, already had remedies in place, and for some reason weren't attaining the goals that the people who designed the rods had thought they were going to attain. So moving on to slide number 35, why do we do optimization during this phase? Well, the first reason is the remedy is not achieving the goals that the people who designed it thought it would. They're not removing as much mass, the plume's not shrinking, they haven't been able to close the site, and the remedy's been operating for 8 or 9 years. There are cost issues, and this also goes to the question earlier from the states. You know, is there an exit strategy for exiting the Superfund site and the transfer of the property from management by the federal government to the states? And a lot of times these revolve around cost. And if you're spending, $100,000, $500,000 a year on a monitoring network, monitoring a remedy that's not actually attaining goals, then that's comes up as a cost issue, but really it's actually a performance issue. Another reason why we do optimization is the long-term protectiveness. If your remedy is not removing enough mass over time and you're not attaining the goals, then your aquifer or your soil or your site is not protective in the long run, and addressing those issues becomes important. During property redevelopment, if you want to turn your site into a Walmart or an apartment complex or a park, the question of where your pump and treat system is, where your monitoring wells are, whether it's protective comes up. And also during this time, transferring sites from Fed control to the state control. We also look at the amount of energy expended, the efficiency of the system, and the amount of effort it takes to run the system. And one of the primary things we're looking at now are exit strategies. So the goal of optimization during long-term response action and O&M is to improve the protectiveness, the efficiency, and the time to completion. Now, what completion means is different for different people, different stakeholders. Completion for the EPA may mean that they turn it over to state control. Completion for the state may mean that they take it off, they delist it completely, and have uncontrolled site use. Completion for the property owner may be ability to sell. So coming to these kind of nitty-gritty details in the exit strategy is what we do at this end of the pipeline. Moving on to slide number 36. What is frequently reviewed during LTMO, which is long-term monitoring optimization and the long-term stage of optimization? The conceptual site model, and I know you've heard this 100 times today, but it's absolutely essential. And for this stage, for sites that have been active for 10, 20, 30 years, we want to see the entire CSM, the original CSM at the time the ROD was written, the original CSM at the time the remedy was designed, and the changes to the CSM during the time that the remedy has been operational. And one of the things that I keep getting in the pulpit about is electronic data management and data organization. And primarily, the first thing I recommend is that data need to be managed electronically. They need to be converted to databases, spreadsheets. You can't use the advanced models that I use to analyze sites and to develop uncertainty models, and you can't use the 3D visualization tools if all of your data are in boxes underneath your desk. So when I ask for a CSM, I want a series of electronic files that can be input into various models and statistical tools. PDFs are okay, but really data management comes to the fore. And it's mainly because I have to examine 30 years of data. Steve, he may have 2 or 3 years of data. Doug may have 8 years of data. But, I get the 30 end. So I can be kind of grouchy about that. Remedies, what are we reviewing? The remedial objectives, the remedial action objectives at the time the ROD was written. The original remedial design, what was it designed to do? Were the pumping wells designed to pull 300 gallons per minute? What were the performance criteria at the time the remedy was designed? A lot of times you'll find that there are no performance criteria. It's install the remedy and hope for the best. So sometimes we have to retroactively go back and design performance criteria if we were going to evaluate the performance of this remedy over time, in terms of mass removal or reduction in mass flux or reduction in plume footprint. What would the data look like? And I want to see the performance data, and I want to correlate the treatment performance with the cost. No. So what is the cost per microgram of contaminant removed? Moving on to slide number 37. Specifically, the data we look at are changes in COC concentrations. And to do this, we have to look at the data collection system, how samples were retrieved, how samples are analyzed, what the detection limits are, how those things have changed over time, whether data collected at the front end of the project are actually comparable with data collected more recently. We look at mass removal rates, and in order to develop mass removal calculations, we have to look at the location of where the samples were taken. We have to look at the frequency of samples, how samples were taken, and we have to interpolate between areas of uncertainty, both spatially and temporally. So another good reason why the data need to be in electronic format. We look at effluent discharge and evaluating the costs and the effort, which includes manpower, labor hours, and in some cases carbon footprint. We can do sustainability analyses, comparing different remedial systems. For example, you know, a pump and treat versus a PRB versus SVE. Different types of remedies can have different footprints, and that may affect how the decisions we make in the future. We look at containment. I think historically, remedies like pump and treat were considered a treatment, and the data to support that are somewhat weak. I think these days we're looking at pump and treat as a containment remedy and focusing more on mass in the source area. So we look at how well the containment systems have worked and whether or not they're still required. And of course, we look at the monitoring network, and the monitoring network should be tied in intimately with the goals and objectives of the remedy, and to develop appropriate performance metrics that can be evaluated quantitatively later on in the process. Monitoring, just for monitoring's sake, is probably not a very efficient strategy. And also, monitoring more frequently than you need to when you're not using the data is inappropriate. However, if you have immediate goals on how to on making decisions, like do we need to turn the active remedy off? Is it time to turn the site over to the state? Then maybe more frequent monitoring would be in order. Moving on.
Mindy, what page are we on here? Sorry.
We're moving on to slide 38.
Okay, great. Thank you. Sorry.
Frequently we review the remedies that are in place. The majority of time, there's some sort of pump and treat system. Pump and treat usually triggers optimization. Soil vapor extraction, how long has it been running? Is it time to turn it off? Monitored natural attenuation is a remedy that's, it's actually a part of every remedy that is instituted. So when we look at the CSM, we evaluate what the strength of each of the attenuation mechanisms are. Is there biodegradation? Is there chemical degradation? Is there precipitation? Is there dilution? Is there dispersion? So we want to get a really good idea of what the strength of all of these natural attenuation mechanisms are. In situ bioremediation, we may look at systems that have been operating for quite a while, looking to see if they've mobilized some metals and how those metals may be attenuating. In situ oxidation, was it enough? Do we need more? We look at caps, slurry walls, reactive barriers, how they're performing, how long their lifespan is anticipated to be. If you're going to turn a site over to the state for their 10% contribution, you want to make sure that nothing is going to fail imminently. So the states are getting pretty particular about these turnover schedules, and they don't want to be stuck with more than their 10% share. So going through and looking at the system as it's functioning now and as it's anticipated to function in the next 10 years is pretty important. Moving on to slide number 39, what is frequently reviewed? Extraction, injection, and monitoring well locations. Are they in the right positions? Are they doing the most that they can? Amendment injections, the amount, the location, the frequency. groundwater extraction performance? Are we pumping as much as we thought we would? Are we removing as much mass as we thought we were going to remove? At what point do we decide that this is not a productive activity anymore? We look at reinjection, release, and reuse of treated water. A lot of times we're looking at systems that are treating water, and the treated water may be actually sold to the municipalities, particularly in drier regions of the country. We look at air stripping, activated carbon, ion exchange processes. Are they performing as they're supposed to? Are the changeout schedules appropriate? Chemical feed and storage, all of the individual components that go into running the remedy. We look at metals mobilization and precipitation, as I mentioned earlier, particularly with in-situ bioremediation remedies. And I think the most important thing we end up looking at is, are conditions data collected since the end of the active remedy? For a lot of sites that have been in the program for a long time, active remedies are being shut down all over the place. And at what point after you shut down the active remedy do you move into an exit strategy? Do you move into a completion? So evaluating the conditions, the residual mass, the movement of residual mass since the end of the active remedy is a very important part of the long-term optimization strategy. Okay, moving on to slide number 40, review findings. As we started out in 2001 doing these, what were supposed to be long-term and exit strategy type of optimizations, we frequently found that the conceptual site model is inadequate to address the questions that we had about the site, which is the primary reason Steve Diamond has a job right now. So back in the early days, the CSM, the sources were not well defined. The heterogeneity in the subsurface were not well defined. NAPL was not addressed. Remedies failed to address certain COCs, 1,4-dioxane, arsenic. So going back and making recommendations for improving the CSM kind of kicks the site back into characterization phase, which a lot of project managers deeply dislike. So that's why we've moved the optimization strategy back into the characterization phase, and we've developed a lot of new tools. So this is exciting, and this is good. We've come a long way in the last 10 years on CSMs. The other thing that we found was that plumes become unstable when the project manager changes. I think the majority of the time that the plume becomes unstable when the project manager changes is that the data are not organized, and they're not in a way that the new project managers and the new stakeholders and the new team members can pick up what's going on. We were just out in one of the regions doing the portfolio of sites, and I asked for boring logs, and I knew the boring logs existed somewhere, but they're in a paper copy in an archive someplace, probably in an armory down the street from some state capital. And that's not doing the new project managers a whole lot of good. It's not doing the site review team a whole lot of good. So the second major review finding is that data management is not quite up to snuff. Tracking and reporting performance is difficult. The spatial data are particularly hard to interpret because there are no XY coordinates. The historic data are, again, in a box under someone's desk or completely gone. So we've lost a lot of institutional knowledge and a lot of opportunity to really refine our remedies and move forward to completion. Moving on to slide number 41. Frequent recommendations include optimizing remedy components, operational improvements, moving toward fewer active remedies and more monitored natural attenuation, and doing monitoring optimization, otherwise known as LTMO. Changing remedy strategies, sometimes focusing a little bit more attention on the source and watching to see how the plume attenuates down gradient after source treatment, and then really getting down in the weeds on the exit strategy. How close are we to cleanup? Statistically, sometimes it's hard to tell. You can be right above the MCL or the cleanup goal and still not be able to close it, but you may be able to redevelop it and you may be able to reduce your long-term cost significantly. The next question we ask are, what data do we need to show that we have attained cleanup? And that's another kind of tricky area. Again, you can be very close to cleanup goals and not be able to substantially demonstrate that you have attained the cleanup goals. So moving on to slide 42, I think I'm going to kick it back to Kirby or answer any questions that might have come up.
Yes, thank you, Mindy. I just wanted to make one little stress on what you said because I think that was really important, and that is the succession planning at the site. We had a question earlier, you know, that the state project managers change over, EPA project managers change over, and I think that's one thing that we found so very often as we've gone out to these sites is that if there is a succession strategy for the data, for the information, for the knowledge about that site that can be passed on conveniently and efficiently in a tight sort of laser fashion to the succeeding project manager, everybody's way, way better off. So with that, let me, Gene, open that to questions, either from the floor or from the internet question and answer.
Okay. Thanks, Kirby. Let's take a quick brief check with our phone line participants. We do have some that came in electronically. You can continue to type those up now as we're talking. But for anybody on the telephone lines, if you have a question and haven't asked it out loud or typed it in already, please feel free to take yourself off of mute. Remember, I've globally muted the line, so you'll need to hit #6 to unmute your line, and then feel free to identify yourself and ask a question. Okay. I'm going to start in with some of the electronic questions, and this is just, I think, going to echo some of what Kirby was just highlighting. We did have a participant who really wanted you to kind of go in and discuss a little bit further that comment about plumes becoming unstable when the RPM changes. And I think they just found that to be a really interesting observation, and if any data has been collected to kind of carry that message back home and talk with organizational managers and how they're handling their staff to prove how transitioning staff can truly impact a site in its cleanup process.
I'm afraid that's an anecdotal and an empirical observation. I just noticed that we get a lot of calls whenever someone has taken over a new site, and there's a lot of uncertainty, which can be good, because a good review of the data can highlight some of the areas they were uncertain about. And it also kind of points to the idea that when a site has had a remedial project manager for a long, long time, there's a human bias to think that they understand it and they're very familiar with it and they know all the features of it. So there may be, you know, and maybe good reason for that. But sometimes, you know, we kind of become accustomed to our uncertainty and fail to recognize it.
Yeah, let me add, Mindy, that one part of the national strategy is, in fact, to develop lessons learned and to disseminate those lessons learned to our regions and to others who are working on the sites so that they can be most appropriately informed about how to proceed. So there is a learning model that is designed to capture these lessons and to identify those to, you know, basically everybody. So just wanted to add that part of it. Another question then?
Yes,
Kirby, I have this, Steve, can I just jump in?
Absolutely, jump in, yeah. We've got another 14 minutes, so we've got to...
Okay, well, I think one way we can deal with that issue, at least, that's what I was trying to get at with this conceptual site model lifecycle document, is that rather than, you know, it's a one-time deal or that sort of thing, that is a living document that's updated along key points along the Superfund pipeline. And that, you know, that process kind of works regardless of whether you're in Superfund, RCRA, or some other program. But the idea is that it serves as sort of a historical reference for what we knew at the time and why we made the decisions that we made. Because when project managers change and when consultants change, the first thing they do is say, well, why did, in 2003, why did we do this or why did we think that? And if we have periodic updates to the conceptual site model that show the data, our understanding of the geology, the hydrogeology, the fate and transport of the contaminants through that time, then we get sort of that historical context. So rather than hand a new project manager 30 years of data, like Mindy says that she'll get handed, they're going to get that data, but they're also going to get the periodic updates to the CSM that has significantly changed as our knowledge about the site has changed. So it provides some historical context about why we did what we did at the time, the decisions that we made, the data that we had, and that sort of thing. And I think the conceptual site model can really be a great tool to help us move through that that process. But I agree with Mindy that anecdotal evidence or not, that definitely when project managers change and consultants change, I don't know if the plume becomes unstable, but certainly there become questions in places where there weren't before. And I think that's something that we can accommodate and deal with through the CSM and also through our exit strategy development.
Thank you, Steve, and I couldn't agree with you more.
Let's take one more. Another question that's coming online. I think this one might generate some conversation as well. We have an attendee in Virginia who wants to know if you have any boilerplates on letters or reports to help convince states and other parties to cut back on the amount and frequency of monitoring. They go on to say that it seems like a great idea, but it's hard to convince stakeholders once it's in the remedial plan.
Well, I think one of the things that I've found doing this for the last 10 years is that you have to get together and actually discuss your monitoring goals and objectives. Every piece of data needs to be tied to an analytical method or an evaluation method and an action. And if you are not going to do anything with the data, then there's no point in taking it. The most expensive piece of data you collect are the data that are not actionable. So once you sit down and make a life cycle for your data, we're collecting it at these locations, we're going to do this type of trend analysis, we're going to see if it's, 95% UCL above this, and when we find that out, then we are going to do X, like turn down the monitoring system or install a contingency system. Then the reason why you're collecting data becomes clear, and the path forward becomes a lot more, it's much easier to develop consensus. But I think you have to have that conversation first. You can't just say, I'm going to blow this off for once every 5 years.
So. Yeah. Mindy, I just wanted to add to that, but, I think with respect to the questioner's question posed, it's really very site-specific, so we don't actually have boilerplate that suggests that, someone should cut back their monitoring well network. That is really on an individual site-by-site, actually well-by-well basis. So there isn't a preference to do this except to optimize to make sure that everything that you're doing out there at that site is both needed and contributes to the site's understanding and is an appropriate response.
Okay. We did have a question that came in earlier, and this attendee wants to know exactly how EPA's optimization efforts interact with similar efforts taken under by the Department of Defense agencies. They want to know who's going to take the lead on optimization activities when you have a federal facility site, and, which approach are you going to use? Are you going to use EPA's optimization approach? Is it going to be the Department of Defense optimization approach, or is there some combination between the two?
Okay, I can take that one. I work very closely with the FRTR groups. That's the Federal Remediation Technologies Roundtable groups. And I work very closely with Navy, Air Force, USAIS and Army, and the next to the last slide, or the last slide in my presentation here, is linkages out to each of those programs. We crossed the Rubicon a little while ago because we said we weren't going to do federal facilities here at EPA. Instead, we would be seeking to ask our federal partners who have very robust optimization programs, some of them, Navy particularly, of course, USAIS has been primary in developing the entire notion of it. Air Force is now in performance-based contracting, but they do have their surveillance program, which I think is very much like optimization. And then Army is, we're continuing to talk with the Army as to how and when we would do something like maybe a munitions plant or something like that. So we have yet to participate with them directly. But on in Keyport and Whidbey Islands, both are Navy bases, we have a co-lead approach going on right now with both of those with the Navy to partially to assess the direction and scope and approach for the Navy's program as compared to EPA's program. And I think we have a pretty pretty close match in a lot of the cases. We still have a little bit of difference in the strategies that they use because they are also using onboard contractors to do this, and only to some extent do they use third-party contractors to do it. They have a different site cadre than we do. They're not all NPL sites. Some of them are very small. There may be 100 of them on a base, little ones here, little ones there, motor pools, firing ranges, and the like. So not all of those sites really require what I would call the full Monty of optimization. But this test program is in progress right now on these two sites to see how that works. Does that answer the questioner's question?
Yeah, I think you did, Kirby. I think you did a great job. Well, you have another question that came in regarding 3D visualization. And, Steve, I'm going to bounce this one back to you. This attendee wants to know if you have any training available or are planning to do training on 3D visualization, specifically relating back to optimization efforts.
That's a great question. And I don't, off the top of my head, I don't know if we have any that ties to optimization. But certainly we have some presentations, and I know for our remedial project managers, I know for at NARPA and internally here at EPA, I've been doing presentations on some of the work that we've been doing with 3D visualizations over the last 5 to 7 years. And in fact, we have a clue-in seminar on a site called Well 12A. It should be archived. I'd have to go back and try to remember the date, but it was sometime last summer, I believe, that we talked about the 3D visualization work that was done at Well 12A. It wasn't specifically tied to optimization, but the process was very much optimization in that we had a remedial system. It was in long-term remedial action. The pump and treat was one of the first rods that the region had put in, one of the first rods that the region had in back in the 80s, and a pump and treat system that had been operating for over 15 years. More than 3 5-year reviews, was essentially capturing most of the contaminants in a dissolved phase plume, but TCE was one of the ones that got away from the site and was impacting a public supply well about several thousand feet away. So we used the 3D visualization in support of optimization, sort of an informal optimization in that basically the region was looking at the performance of that system, and the STL in the region, the Superfund technical liaison, and the remedial project manager were both interested in moving that site forward rather than continuing with the status quo. That was a site where there was some disagreement over whether or not the system was truly deemed operational and functional, which is something that we do when we finish our construction complete after the shakedown period. We try to determine that the system is operational and functional and functioning in the manner in which it was designed. There was some disagreement over whether that system was operational and functional because they didn't have complete plume capture of all of the contamination. But our work in the 3D visualization focused on a couple of different areas in terms of remediation. We had a very shallow zone of filter cake material from, it was a solvent recycler, and that filter cake material was left in place. We've since gone back, the region has since gone back and removed that material. They went back and also did some high-resolution site characterization techniques, particularly beneath the facility where it was deemed that the presence of DNAPL was likely and would create significant problems for a traditional pump and treat system. They went back and did that and did the high-resolution site characterization. They used MIP. They used a variety of tools and sort of mapped out that contamination. And last I heard, the thermal work was on the street. So the final remedy, which was initially a pump and treat, has become a pump and treat, which is essentially serving as a containment remedy for now. Some shallow excavation, which really should have been done probably years earlier, but we did better delineation and excavated that material that was easy to get to. A thermal remedy that's going after high concentration, DNAPL-type concentrations of chlorinated beneath the building. And then they're using mass flux, a line of mass flux wells down gradient from there to monitor a zone where they're doing enhanced reductive dechlorination. And they believe that if they can knock that TCE concentration down to below 300 micrograms per liter at that mass flux location, that by the time that plume reaches the point of compliance, which is the municipal well down gradient, that they will be able to achieve MCLs. So right now the well is pumping. They're getting TCE in excess of the MCL, which is 5 micrograms per liter, and they're treating it at the wellhead. And the hope is that with the additional work that's been done in the excavation, the small thermal footprint, and the enhanced reductive dechlorination, that that site will truly be operational and functional and will be able to achieve its cleanup goals in the very near future. And we did a presentation on that site last summer. So we do have examples, and we do have lots of 3D training and other things. I keep an eye on Kluin. I keep an eye on TrainX about where we're going to be doing those things. But directly tied to optimization so far, I can't say that we have done it, but we are working on some very large plumes, very large sites with a lot of operational history, a lot of system operation history, including a site in Region 9 that's some 20-some-odd square miles and a very, very large plume, 1,200 feet deep. So we are using 3D visualization tools, the latest and greatest in that bag of tricks, to help us with those sites. And to the extent that those sites are being looked at from an optimization purview, we are bringing in 3D statistical evaluation and analysis.
Okay, great.
Thanks, Steve.
Kirby, I don't see any more questions coming in on the online queue since the phone lines have been pretty quiet. Why don't we go ahead and turn things back to you to make any closing statements or comments before I direct everyone on how to access resources, submit feedback, and get confirmation for attending today.
Okay. Thanks, Jean. Last page, the slide 40, I'm sorry, let me pull this down so I can see it. Slide 42 has links out to the EPA's remedy optimization page. I'm going to be replacing that page very soon with one that matches the strategy. So the current two pages there will be combined. And the remedy optimization page is actually the EPA.gov one. The Kluin optimization page is what I was talking about just now. And then there are Corps, Army, Air Force, Navy, FRTR, the Federal Remediation Technologies Roundtable, and the Interstate Technology Regulatory Council, which has some significant amounts of resources on optimization. With that, I will say, Gene, let me turn it over to you for the final closing remarks, and thanks everybody for attending this. Please be sure to come to our May 8th case studies, and you'll be able to see actually how this works. Those are set up with a background and then findings, recommendations, and implementation status. So those are going to be real interesting.
Great. Thank you so very much, Kirby. Let me go ahead and direct everybody through some of our final remarks today. So I'm on slide number 44, which is our resources and feedback slide. That is an active hyperlink slide, so if you're looking at electronically, you can click on the links for additional resources into the feedback form. On the additional resources page, you're going to find a collection of websites as well as the files that were used for today's presentation. And then the feedback form will take a moment or two just to fill out and let us know what you thought of today's broadcast. If you're not actively at a computer with internet and are looking at a hard copy of the materials, you can find those very same pages on the seminar homepage. So just refer back to the initial email that you used to get to today's seminar and follow the links that you see on the far left side to both the feedback form and the resources or links pages. I do read each and every one of the feedback forms that are submitted, so I welcome people who can share their thoughts on how we can improve these sessions in the future. If you're familiar with our newer platform, like Adobe Connect, you'll see some questions asking what you thought of this one versus that one. And again, we welcome and thank everybody in advance for sharing your thoughts on our session. If you shared the line with multiple parties, each person can submit feedback on their own. When you fill out the form once, there'll be a link that will appear that will let another person hop on and fill out their own form. Again, if you're not doing it right now, that feedback form is active from this point forward. Even if you're listening to the recorded version of today's seminar, you too can submit feedback for today's session when you're replaying the event by following those links to the feedback form. If you're looking for verification...
Gene, let me just invite people. I mean, I'd love to hear your feedback, so just let me just say that. Thanks.
Yes, we do love feedback. We can never get enough feedback. And like Kirby said, it really does help us to improve our deliveries. If you are looking to get credit for participating today, we don't necessarily issue training certificates on CLUIN. However, we find that a lot of our participants are able to earn credit with their training organization or officer by simply saving the registration email, a copy of the presentation materials, and by submitting feedback. When you fill that form out, there's a picture of this on slide 44, you can check a box and have a confirmation email sent to you. That email will at least confirm that you submitted feedback after the live delivery. So if you take that with the other items I mentioned, you should be able to get credit for joining our session today. So I'm going to move everybody along to the final slide, which is number 45. And again, just reminding everybody that the Cleanup Information Network or CLUIN.org website is actually powered by a number of staff that work here at EPA in the Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division. We always look forward to sharing information and gathering new information from interested parties. So you can either visit us and submit information on the CLUIN website or reach out to us through some of our more popular professional and social networking sites on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. I want to thank the nearly 70 individuals who joined us from all over the country for today's live broadcast, and just remind you that you will automatically get an email as soon as the recorded version of today's event is available. As Kirby mentioned, Part 2 will be delivered on May 8th, so if you haven't signed up already, I'd refer you to the CLUIN training page. You can go to cluin.org and follow the links for training on the right side of the screen and register for Part 2. Thank you all so very much for joining us. I want to thank all of the presenters are able to join us from a variety of locations. And again, hope that everybody found this to be an informative use of your time today. This will be the formal conclusion for today's CLUIN seminar. Thank you, and I hope you have a great rest of your day.